Welcome to another exciting episode here at IT Pro TV. I'm your host, Mike Roderick. Today we're doing our CISSP content, and specifically we're going to be going into designing and establishing secure communications or secure communication channels, right? We've talked about communication channels in previous conversations. We've got to make sure that that information that we're sending across those channels is protected and that those bad actors, whoever wants it, can't get access to it. So here to help us with all that is Mr. Adam Gordon. How's it going, Adam?
It's going well. Now, I could tell you that, except if I tell you that securely, then I'd have to obviously encrypt that communication and nobody would understand it. So instead, what I'm going to do is this.
Awesome. I like it.
All right. So let's talk a bit about secure communication channels, how they work, what they are. You know, we often start out at kind of the baseline, right? And we've talked a lot about older technologies and kind of worked our way up to newer ones, reminding ourselves historically some of the things that's gone on, where we've been, in other words, to help us to understand where we're going. So when we start this conversation, we want to start out talking about voice generically, not because it's older or newer, but just because it's a great place to think about starting a conversation like this, because voice touches, voice communication does, many of the things that we think about and we do today. We have what's called the plain old-fashioned telephone system, what we commonly refer to as the POTS network, that would have been the PSTN, the publicly switched telephone network, that we historically have used for analog communication. We would send voice communication over that. We may have what I mentioned earlier, which would have been the PBX, the private branch exchange. Would have been an analog PBX. These days would be a digital VoIP solution, a voice over IP solution, kind of morphing that technology, blending data and voice on the same system through the same network lines, and then having to secure and segment that traffic, manage it with quality of service, what we call QoS, securing it with encryption, but also dealing with things such as jitter and sequencing errors, where we may have problems because of latency in the communication, causing disruption to the signal, and or sequencing errors where packets show up out of sequence, as we talked about sequence numbers and how important they are. And if packets show up out of sequence, then we may start hearing things that sound much like, and this may, yeah, like that, right? And that's not you,
days.
By the way. It's not your ears. That's me purposely doing that. That could be jitter, but that could also be a question of sequencing errors. So what a sequence error would actually sound like would be that you would hear, instead of the dog is blue, you would hear the blue is dog, because the packets show up out of sequence and are delivered and then reconstructed in an incorrect manner. So we could have all of these problems and concerns, right, showing up and doing these kind of things. So we want to be thinking about this. When we think about securing channels and communications and networks, we have to think about not just the actual encryption, do I keep the packets and the data away from the bad guys, but am I also securing in the sense that I'm optimizing and performance managing data so it shows up the right way, follows the right paths, is reproduced correctly. Latency, in other words, right, transmission errors due to latency and sequencing problems can present as big of a challenge because they knock out the concept of availability as packets that are not encrypted and are stolen from us and expose confidentiality. So we remember we have three distinct pillars of information security management we focus on. In this case, availability is going to be a very, very significant concern for us, and we have to equally focus there. We talked about modems earlier in one of our prior episodes, talked about them again here with voice. I mentioned the whole concept of what a modem does. Gave you the historical reference for thinking about why modems may be important, why they are valuable to us. We talked about War Games, right, potentially as a movie you may want to watch. In another thing you saw in War Games, aside from the modem being used to hack, was that actually that hacking that the modem was used to carry out is given a very specific name. It's called war dialing. At least that was the old school way of breaking into systems with modems. And war dialing is these days primarily a historical footnote, but it's actually making a comeback, believe it or not, because we have modems, as I said, in a lot of these older systems. And from a maintenance perspective, we are seeing them being exposed now to the internet through IP enabling on systems that may not realize they still have modems associated with them. And because of that, because we're now seeing these systems be effectively modernized and be exposed, the evidence of modems being there may be found by hackers when they're probing and looking, and they may now try to get into those modems and use them against us. So yet again, doing a security inventory, understanding what's available to you becomes very important, because what's available to you is also available to the
bad actors.
Absolutely correct. So war dialing, something very important to think about. Now, a more modern version of war dialing is something called war chalking and or war driving. War driving and war chalking are kind of the same thing. One is done in a car, one is done without a car, but they both focus on the same activity. Hopefully you picked up on that subtle but important difference in the reference there. They both deal with wireless networks, and they deal with the fact that war driving is effectively somebody driving, literally more often than not in a car, going around looking for wireless signals that are open. And, you know, when I travel, and I travel a great deal to do what I do, I spend a lot of time in, various places around the world, not just in the U.S., but I travel globally, internationally to do a lot of the work I do. I'm often looking to get on the internet when I'm in strange places. I may or may not necessarily have access to it directly. So I will typically go online ahead of time knowing where I'm going, and I will look for coverage maps, maps that people have actually put up ahead of time. And there are sites out there you can go and find. And I'm not talking about cell phone coverage maps. I'm talking about open wireless access point coverage maps. So people have war drove, if I can say that, or war drived. I don't know if that's the proper terminology for the past tense. War driven, perhaps. I'm not an English grammatician. I'm definitely not. Math, English, not my forte at all. But if they have war driven through an area and they've marked all the open wireless access points, they will typically put coverage maps up that will then tell you how you can find them, and then obviously you can potentially choose to take advantage of them. Let me be clear. I'm not suggesting for a minute that you use this information to hack into a business. I'm not suggesting for a minute that you use this information to get up to no good. I'm merely pointing out to you that somebody has probably done the due diligence and homework in terms of mapping the open sites. If you choose to connect across one and use it, that's up to you. That may or may not be legal. I'm simply pointing out that that information exists out there, and I want to be clear about that, right? Never want you to think for a minute that I'm suggesting you should engage in a certain kind of behavior just because I talk about the fact that that's a possibility. So it is possible to find this information online. War chalking allows you, and it's done typically in the inner city core, in downtown areas, typically in the financial districts, business districts, where people actually walk around instead of war driving, right? They'll mark the buildings and the open access points on a site coverage map, but they actually will also chalk. They will mark the actual open access points in front of buildings. So if you know what to look for, you may see graffiti tags on the side of a building. You may see literally somebody's painted something on the sidewalk. It takes different forms. It may be a street sign in front of the building. Somebody's put a sticker up there, kind of hidden from view. You have to know what to look for. But war chalking is the idea of marking these open access points in buildings so that people that know what to look for know they are there and know how to use them. It's just another way to communicate this information. It's got a lot of interesting little subcultural context going on with some of this. We have indeed an entire community and a language and a context and behavior around these kind of activities that as security professionals, we at least have to educate ourselves about enough to understand how to interact with, because that is indeed what we're talking about here. Remember peer-to-peer applications? Remember P2P applications, file sharing, Napster, big, huge issue with Napster? You had FileZilla, you had Morpheus, LimeWire, Kazaa, Bear-to-Bear, or BearShare, ShareBear, BearShare, whatever the hell it was. Right? You had all these different ones out there, and they're still around. There are some that are still around, but the reality is they really have not become common anymore, in the sense that they are illegal for the most part. The government tends to crack down on these when they become a little too big. If you remember the whole mega upload disaster and what went on with that system, where people were eventually, because they were using this technology to effectively share files illegally, government came in, shut down mega, took all their servers, took all their data, and just one day they're there, next day they were gone. So these applications can have a dark side to them. But we want to know that peer-to-peer applications and peer-to-peer sharing protocols do exist potentially. They may still be in use and in play in your networks, and they effectively allow for what I'll call unmonitored and unrestricted file sharing. We may be aware of them. We may know they're happening. We may be able to pick up on this. But the challenge is it's very difficult to constrain this traffic because they usually would use dynamically assigned ports and jump, right? So the systems would jump from port to port trying to find open places where they could transmit through the firewall. So this became a bit of a challenge. So botnets, spyware, viruses were all fed by these kind of networks. If you would go out, and a modern version of this would be using BitTorrents, right? So if you're familiar with BitTorrents and downloading, and shame on you, by the way, if you said yes, did you do this, right? Because if you're using it for good, not a problem. But the reality is, for every good reason, you may go out and use a BitTorrent to download something legitimate. You also see a lot of people using BitTorrents and torrent software to download things like movies and software that are not licensed, that are not legal, that they're not paying for. That is illegal activity. We want to be clear about that. And that is not something we should sponsor or support as a CISSP. We should not allow others to engage in that behavior and that activity at work. What they do on their own time privately is up to them, but that activity can lead to compromise because even if they're downloading stuff that may be legitimate from those sites, a lot of times that stuff is laced with malware or viruses and software that can do harm. And by executing that program, what we would call a Trojan program, a program within a program may pop up, and you may execute the pink, purple, unicorn wallpaper program, because that's what you want, and inside is the nasty little spyware, malware program that crawls out and infects your system without your knowledge. So you have to be very careful about these kinds of systems. They can really lead to a lot of compromise. Remote meeting technologies, right? We use things like Skype for Business. We probably use WebEx, things of that nature all the time. This is just another area that we have to think about and examine as a security professional. How are we allowing technology to effectively drive communication, and how is communication through this technology platform driving information dissemination? These are things we have to think about. Can I do a file share, a desktop share, an audio and a video share or provisioning of information through these technology platforms? Absolutely. Can I turn on a camera in one of these platforms, pan it around a room, and see everything in there, including pictures of proprietary sensitive information that may be hanging around? Absolutely. This is one of the reasons when you go into secure private facilities or military installations, you're not allowed to carry electronics with you. Only under special circumstances can you bring in a laptop, and it takes almost an act of Congress to get one onto a base today. And I can tell you that from firsthand experience, because I spent a lot of time in these places. And I can tell you, I'm never allowed to bring my technology platforms in. I'm not allowed to bring a phone in, because they are worried about the fact that these have microphones, they have cameras, they could be rooted today, so somebody could have put malware in there. They could be remotely controlled and turned on as a listening device inside of a sensitive area. They could be recording information. Same thing with laptops. You're hooking up an unknown quantity to a secure network. There's no way, right, that that's ever going to happen in most of the places I work in. So I'm politely told, listen, you know, whatever you need, make sure it's available to you in another form that we approve before you show up, because you're not bringing it in on a laptop. I taught a class just probably about 6 or 8 weeks ago. A set of classes, two classes with about a week break in between, on a secure base, right? A secure army base or navy base. Won't tell you which, but it was a secure base, right? And so I was on a secure base, and I was actually inside an incredibly secure perimeter of a secure base. So I was working in a very secure area of a base that was already highly secured. And I had brought my, as I typically do, I have my go bag with me, right? So I have my laptop, my tablet, all that stuff. I was very politely told, hey, that's all good. Bring it with you. It stays in the dorm. You don't walk out with it. Between the car and the dorm, okay, out beyond that perimeter, don't even think about bringing it with you to the other building, because we're not going to let you in with it. So we had a bit of a challenge the first day of class, because we had to get the courseware material and the slides and all the stuff I needed into the training facility. And I wasn't able to bring it in any other way, and I had to bring it in on a USB drive. They said, okay, bring it on a USB drive, so I did that. But then they stopped me right at the border there and said, well, what the hell is this thing? You're not bringing this in. And I said, okay, well, talk to the guy who told me, bring it in. So now we have the whole discussion about how are we going to transmit this data through the security checkpoint. So somebody had to come out from IA, from Information Assurance, had to take that device, scan it, then certify it was okay to bring it into a secure area to then not let me use it, but to transfer the data off that removable device onto a CD, and then give me the burned CD that could then be put into the training machines that were set up so that we could transmit that data. There was no way, in other words, I was bringing a USB device onto the base, because it's effectively a mechanism that I could export data out with, and it was just unacceptable. So this was, again, pretty common. This happens all the time. But this is the kind of thing we think about, and CISSPs have to be involved with when we're thinking about how we manage these technologies and these levels of access today, right? Very important stuff. So remote meeting technology and remote meeting technology risks, obviously. Very many of them that we want to think about as well. Instant messaging. We talked a bit about this. We talked about Skype and things like that. But instant messaging in general can lead to all sorts of complications. There are different categories of instant messaging. We may have text messages between phone systems today, what we call SMS or short message capabilities. So, you traditionally text message. That can lead to compromise. I think I made this reference in at least one other episode early on. Somebody can send you a link to something in an SMS message, and you may click on it on a phone. That link is effectively an invitation to connect to something. If that something is going to have a system that has malware on it, you may very well infect the platform you're connecting from. Now, it's kind of interesting, right? Because I run a BlackBerry, and I'm very open about that. I'm a proud BlackBerry user, right? And I have been since the very first BlackBerries came out. When they first previewed, I bought several of those devices, and I've basically been a BlackBerry adherent ever since. Whether you like BlackBerry or not, Sucks for you. I don't really care. I like them. That's all that matters. But one of the most secure platforms you can use today, still almost 15 to 17 years later since they first previewed, for enterprise level communications, right? I'm not talking about consumer devices that we do a lot of other things on. I'm talking about a secure device I can run a business off of. I can send secure email. I can have communications. I can do certain things. So the idea with a BlackBerry is kind of interesting because unlike a lot of other mobile devices, I can preview an email on the BlackBerry, and we can all do this on our devices. I can click on a link to a website on the BlackBerry, but because of the browser the BlackBerry uses natively, which is not an Internet Explorer, not a Chrome browser, right? Not Safari, right? It's a different browser. It's a secure browser, and I have several other secure browsers loaded on my BlackBerry as well. But because of that, when I preview something, if I click on a link and I go out to that website, if it is in any way compromised, BlackBerry basically just says, hey, guess what? Number one, this is not a good idea, so we're not going to show it to you. But more importantly, even if you go there, you're not going to be able to download anything. So nothing's going to infect my platform. There's really minimal of any malware out there specifically targeted at BlackBerry. It's because five people on the planet still use it, so it's really not a high-value target. But the five of us are very happy with the security level in terms of our communication platform, right? But when you think about Windows mobile devices, think about Android devices, think about Apple devices, we hear stories on a fairly regular basis about malware hitting these mobile platforms because hackers have realized that a lot of electronic information, a lot of payment information, a lot of sensitive data is transiting these devices today. And as a result of that, it's a primary target for us to go out and try to think about. So instant messaging is also one of these areas that we want to be thinking about. We don't tend to use a lot of IRC anymore, Internet Relay Chat. You know, maybe at the height of IRC on one of the most up-to-date and, you know, really robustly used networks today, you may have 30 or 40, maybe 50,000 users at a peak on any one of these networks. It's very, very small, kind of off in the corner business case today. A lot of die-hard advents that are still using it. It's still a valid communication mechanism. It's a client-server-based solution that allows us to effectively exchange information. This is the precursor to what now texting and chatting through something like Link or Skype for Business or AOL's Instant Messenger or Yahoo or whatever would have been. IRC is like old school internet version one for that. But there's still systems out there that are doing this kind of chatting and are still used to exchange information. Again, as a CISSP, if one of those 50,000 users is one of ours, we got to understand the impact of that and understand that traffic, monitor it, and make sure we're aware of it because that can lead to compromise. We effectively are sending unencrypted traffic through IRC, which means if somebody is spending time on these platforms chatting and is sending proprietary sensitive information, it goes unencrypted across the wire. And somebody could then pick up on that, as we showed you with something like a capture program, such as Etherreel or any of the programs out there today. So that's, again, something to think about. VPNs, virtual private networks, right? Very valuable resource and tool that we've used for a very, very long time. We're moving away from the general thought process of VPNs in the traditional sense. Client server, yes, but agent-based client software installed to do VPNs. We're now effectively moving towards VPN-less VPNs, in effect. No agent-based software, but still getting the advantage of using tunneling and the encryption and protection capabilities that we have. Some of the newer, more modern versions of VPNs, in other words, don't require agent-based software. They are using tunneling across common protocols to be able to effectively set up and establish these secure communication channels. So VPNs are very valuable, important for us to be aware of. But again, one of the challenges with them is that because they were complicated to set up, because we had agent-based software that had to be configured a certain way, and we had to make sure it was not only set up, but that we had the right credential in there. If you didn't remember the credential, we didn't know what it was. There were all these headaches. So a lot of times you'd have a VPN, which was a good secure communication mechanism, but then you'd spend a lot of time on support trying to get it to work the right way. People got frustrated, and as a result, they bypassed using it and would take data out of the network and use it locally instead of connecting to it remotely as an offset. They would effectively go around the control. So the problem was that now the data was on the local machine. If they did that, and the local machine was compromised, then all of a sudden we exposed all the data that would have been safely secure if we left it in the network and connected to it remotely through a VPN. So technology can be good, but technology that is good but complicated and doesn't work easily and well is actually bad. It's not bad because it doesn't do its job. It's bad because ultimately the end users don't find value in it. And this is one of the things that as CISSPs really have to be aware of. You know, we can come up with incredibly complicated, complex technological solutions to problems. I don't doubt for a minute that most of you out there are capable of coming up with some really cool and innovative ways to do the things we do every day that may involve new technologies that may or may not be well understood. That's all good. We want that innovation. We want that to happen. That's good. Problem is, if it's not something that's easily translatable into a user's world, then what will ultimately happen is the users will simply ignore and bypass that control. They just won't use it. And VPNs effectively are a good example of that technology. They became very difficult and tedious to use. Most users decided it wasn't worth the trouble. So while we had a good solution, it was implemented poorly. This is the web conversation, right, all over again. And as a result of that, because it wasn't easy to use, it became less valuable. CISSPs have to do two things and do them well. We ultimately have to make sure that we are able to translate the incredibly complex environments we operate in into simple, distillable solutions for users that allow them to operate securely. And we then have to document what we've done and make sure we test to enforce the documentation and the policies and procedures, make sure we know what's going on. And if we find a problem, we have to step back and re-engineer the solution to make sure it is usable. This is really distilled down in its essence what CISSPs do. We do a lot more than that, by the way. I'm not saying that's the only thing we do. But when you get right down to it, it's our job to make the incredibly complex simple. Simple enough that average users will actually follow the rules. If we can do that, we've done our job well. If we can't, we got to really think about what we're doing and are we doing the right things for the right reasons. So VPNs are good technology, but VPNs can also lead to challenges and concerns. How do we use a VPN? Well, we connect up and we create what's called a tunnel ultimately to secure two endpoints and then to effectively establish communication between them. What are the protocols that may be used to create tunnels? One of them is PPTP, point-to-point tunneling protocol. Another one is L2TP, layer two tunneling protocol. Layer two tunneling protocol is going to actually take PPTP, which is a, you know, kind of a Gen 1 first generation tunneling protocol that was very popular and still remains so and is still used, but it's used under the guise of a new technology, combines PPTP with something known as L2F, layer two forwarding protocol, which is a proprietary Cisco protocol that exists at layer two of the OSI model at the data link layer. We combine the two together and we get a rebranded repurposed protocol called L2TP, layer two tunneling. So PPTP is going to be a tunneling protocol that's actually very valuable. And the reason it sits at the heart of L2TP is for two very important reasons. You actually know what they might be? You may or may not know.
Built-in encryption capabilities.
So it does have built-in encryption capabilities, absolutely. So that's one of the very important reasons why we do this, because one of the downsides to L2TP by itself without something else is that it does not encrypt natively. So that is something to consider. But there's also another reason. Another reason that PPTP was very, very important is that it allowed us to tunnel protocols and run them over other protocols that normally would not allow for those protocols to be transmitted. In other words, like all good tunneling protocols, right? We're able to transmit protocols that may or may not be routable inside of a tunnel through protocols that are. So in other words, we could take, if we really wanted to, right? Think about the logic of this. You could take NetBIOS and tunnel it through a PPTP connection and route it even though it was never supposed to leave your subnet. Now, that's kind of silly, and if you do that, you need a hobby. Get out and talk to people more, right? Square dancing, something, but you don't want to do that. But my point is, it would allow us to be able to tunnel non-routable transmissions through a tunnel and send it out. It does allow for things like the addition of IPsec, PPTP does, so certainly that's important. It does offer, potentially, the opportunity to include encryption, depending on how we would set it up and what we would do with it. But it really formed the basis for us for what we think of as modern tunneling protocols because it was so flexible and it did so many things. But there were limitations, right? And so we updated it with L2TP, layer 2 tunneling protocol, PPTP plus L2F. But the downside to L2TP is that there's no native encryption, no native authentication. So we often pair that with what's known as IPsec. IP security, which is a security protocol. We talked about that when we talked about the OSI model. IPsec provides authentication and encryption for us, or at least the ability to provide authentication and encryption. And so we often will see and hear L2TP deployed with IPsec. IPsec effectively is a suite of protocols for communicating securely, if you want to think of it that way. And that's what we do there. IPsec is made up of several components. We want to have a general knowledge of what they are. We have authentication headers, what are known as AH. Authentication headers are AH. The authentication headers are going to provide the authentication capabilities. So the integrity capabilities and the authentication capabilities come to us there. We also have encapsulation or encapsulating security payload, ESP, which is providing the confidentiality protection, the encryption, if you will, of the data. And then we have what is known as a security association or what's known as an SA. The SA is a one-way agreement, a one-way negotiated agreement unidirectional. We ultimately need two, so it's going to be a two one-way communication agreement conversation to get bidirectional capabilities for IPsec to be applied. But an SA is effectively a one-way communication agreement negotiated between, let's say, the sender and the receiver in one direction that stipulates how IPsec will be set up and used. So it's effectively like an SLA, if you want to think about it, for a one-way communication channel to be set up and established and managed. That's what an SA represents. So you have authentication headers, you have encapsulating security payload, which is the extensible protocol set that allows us to provide confidentiality, and then security associations that are negotiated one-way agreements to govern communication. These are the building blocks and components of IPsec. Now, IPsec with L2TP is now going to be implemented, or L2TP with IPsec, is implemented in one of two modes. We're going to implement that in either what's called tunnel mode or transport mode. So we have to just quickly talk about the difference between the two. We often talk about the fact, when we think about IPsec or L2TP with IPsec, we think about how we tunnel and how we transport. And what I often remind my students of is that we transport up to the LAN, or through the LAN. You can think of us transporting to the LAN side of the router or the gateway, and then we tunnel through the router. So we transport on the LAN, and we tunnel through the WAN, because we tunnel between endpoints, between wide area network endpoints, which are routers, and we transport on the local area network. So transport mode is used on the LAN. Tunnel mode is used between routing endpoints on the WAN. And if that works for you and helps you to figure that out, then obviously, that's something to consider. But tunnel mode is going to be implemented between routers. Transport mode is implemented on the local area network side to be able to effectively transmit between an endpoint, a workstation of some kind, and or server, excuse me, and ultimately up to the local area network side, the LAN side of the router, or the LAN side of the gateway, if you will, is where we see transport mode. So we just want to think about that and be aware of that. We also have something known as Internet Key Exchange, or IKE. IKE is going to allow us to effectively exchange keys between the members that are going to be involved in negotiating the SAs and using IPsec. This is all still part of the IPsec conversation. So two devices that are exchanging symmetric keys, private keys, for the use of encryption inside of IPsec are going to use IKE, Internet Key Exchange, in order to do that. Now, we have a couple of different key exchange methods. IKE is the overarching thought process we think about. We use Diffie-Hellman. Diffie-Hellman is the traditional key exchange method we use. We can also use public key certificates, and we've talked about certificates, and if you remember that conversation, how certificates can be used and why, we can also use that. But Internet Key Exchange, IKE generically, refers to the idea of being able to exchange these private keys and negotiate the use of them, and the mechanism for doing so is typically referred to as the use of Diffie-Hellman, which is a key exchange protocol that we can use to do that with IPsec. We also want to think about remote authentication protocols that track usage across systems. We commonly refer to this as RADIUS technology. Remote Authentication Dial-In User Service is what RADIUS stands for. RADIUS systems, believe it or not, are still very popular. It's just you don't really tend to see them in most modern networks directly because they are typically used by service providers. So we often see them at the internet service provider level where they are using them to be able to do three things. We refer to the AAA aspect of RADIUS traditionally. We think about authentication, we think about authorization, and we think about auditing as the three A's that are represented by the RADIUS capability. So RADIUS is effectively going to sit on the border, right, of your network, a RADIUS solution will, and it's going to intercept all inbound traffic that is actually looking to come in and gain access to your system. So any of the remote access technology, remote access traffic coming in, is going to pass its traffic stream through a RADIUS device. RADIUS is then going to look to authenticate, to authorize, and to audit. So what RADIUS does is it's a cutout. It's a proxy for inbound authentication traffic. RADIUS server says, hey, stop right here on the border. Stay right here. I'm going to go check on your credentials and see whether you are legitimate or not. And the RADIUS server goes off over here. Goes right over there, right? And let's pretend for just a minute that that thing I'm pointing to right there is actually our directory service controller. In plain old-fashioned English, that's a domain controller. So the RADIUS server is going to talk to the domain controller and find out whether the credentials provided are legitimate. The goal is we don't want the inbound traffic to talk directly to the domain controller, because if it's a spoofed traffic send or a masquerade of some kind, we may have a bad actor that gains advantage by getting directly into the network and can then take advantage of that access to do evil and to do harm. So the RADIUS box cuts out that traffic send, proxies it in effect, stops it at the border. It goes over on behalf of the system, says, hey, is this authentic? The transmission then comes back to the Radius server and says, yes, it is. If that's the case, we then authorize the user and then we allow that traffic stream in. If the answer is no, we'd shut it off and don't allow it in. This is how a Radius box works. But in addition, if we do allow it in, we then are doing what's called auditing, our third A in the AAA. The auditing is the actual session management and, more importantly, session monitoring that takes place so that we log all the events that take place during the session. Who are you? Where are you going to? Where are you coming from? What are you doing? So ISPs use this to be able to keep track of what is going on in their systems. When you get that nasty cease and desist letter from the ISP because you're using P2P technology to BitTorrent files you're not supposed to, the reason they know that is because they're using Radius servers to keep track of what you're doing. And they can tell that you're up to no good because they're auditing your connections. Wake up, people. Everybody's listening to what you're doing. You should know better, right? There's no such thing as privacy in the digital domain anymore. So this is what Radius technology does, and this is how Radius servers are going to be used. We also have older, old school, real old school technology, Diameter and TACAX or TACAX Plus, reaching back into our grab bag of historical irrelevancies. So Diameter was actually an improvement on Radius. So it's like Radius, but Radius Plus. It was never really very popular, never really was deployed widely. It was a standard that was kind of thrown out there for a while. People thought about it. Never really went anywhere. It's really just a historical footnote, but it was like, kind of like an improved version of Radius. Radius was good enough that we kind of just have it around still doing what it does today. TACAX and TACAX Plus were really just another version of this thought process to keep track of things that are going on. But what they really did was they encrypted the entire transmission for us so the exchange of user credentials during authentication would not be exposed. And so this is what the TACAX and TACAX Plus solutions also did for us.
All right. Well, you know, there's a lot of good information about these establishing these secure communication channels. I know we've got more to go, but unfortunately, we're out of time for this particular episode. So we're going to break right here. We're going to come back with more. Remember, if you guys want to see Adam or attend one of Adam's classes live, shoot us an email, cadam@itpro.tv. For this one, we're going to go ahead and sign off. I'm Mike Roderick.
I am a modem. I'm analog and digital all in one. Here I am. I'm a teapot. Here's my pretty spout. I'm only kidding. I'm Adam Gordon. Come on back and join us for our next conversation. We're going to keep talking about this stuff and get through all the rest of the technology you need to know about in order to be successful on the exam.
Very good. We'll see you soon.